We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer, and Jason Croft is now at the controls. Jane Addams was one of the most influential political leaders of her time. In 1889, in Chicago, she co-founded Hull House, the nation's first settlement house. 4 years later, she co-founded Chicago's first homeless shelter for women. She was a leader in the women's suffrage movement and was the first American woman to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And those are just a few of her achievements. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll talk about the life of Jane Addams. And our guest is Louise Knight. She's a writer, a consultant to nonprofits, a former journalist and college administrator, and she's the author of a book, two biographies of Jane Addams. Her new book, the one that's just out now, is titled Jane Addams, Spirit in Action, and that book is published by W.W. Norton. She's also the author of the book Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy, which covers, roughly speaking, the first half of her life, and then the new book, Spirit in Action, is intended as a more comprehensive look at her entire life. The book is out now, so if you're interested in taking a look at it, you can seek it out in the bookstore or the library. If you'd like to find out more about our guest, you can take a look at her website, which is louisewknight.com. And one thing I do want to mention is an event that's coming up later this week on Friday. It's Jane Addams Day in Illinois, and as part of the state celebration this year, she'll be speaking this is on the 12th she'll be speaking, and she'll be speaking at the Jane Addams Hull House Museum. And so if you're interested and you're up there in the Chicago area, you can take advantage of that. Otherwise, questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can always send along your comments and questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Louise Knight, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. I think that when I think of Jane Addams, I guess the very first thing I think about is Hull House. Maybe that's because I'm an Illinoisan and grew up near Chicago. But the list of her activities, all of the areas in which she worked, and the movements that she was associated with, women's suffrage and civil rights and labor organizing, and she also was involved in peace and justice movements. It's truly remarkable, the broad range of her activities.
Well, I appreciate your noting that right off the top, because you aren't the only person who, when they think of Jane Addams, thinks of Hull House.
Mm-hmm.
And while that's certainly appropriate, she is, as you are saying, someone who was doing a whole lot more than simply founding and operating a very important settlement house. So, she had an amazingly broad portfolio of interests and issues that she worked on, and it's quite mind-boggling for most of us today, because I think, I don't know if others would agree, that it seems like today more people specialize. You know, they sort of, they dig deep into one issue. And, of course, people did that in Addams' day as well. But I think it's even more the case today.
Well, and I think, though, you could certainly see how it is that all of these things that she was interested in are connected. Ultimately, we're talking about some very basic issues of social justice all the way across the board.
Yeah, obviously, I think that is the reason also that she became involved in so many different issues, was that she saw it that way. She was, I like to call her, and I'm not the only one, a moral philosopher as well as a political activist. And so that meant that when she undertook to become active on a particular issue, she was seeing it from sort of the broadest moral perspective about human beings and what they owed each other. And a lot of her social action came out of that broader framework. And, of course, that broader framework led her down these very many different paths.
Mm-hmm. She very clearly she was ambitious, and that is something I know that as you've talked about this, have pointed out that ambition is not always a quality appreciated in women. Clearly, she wanted to make the world a better place, but I think also over time she has been criticized some for being a fame seeker. I think you really have tried to say that. If she was looking for recognition, it was because she knew that that is something that would further the work, and it was not something that she was interested in for its own sake.
I think that's right, although this gets into human psychology, always a complicated subject. And I wouldn't say that the popular acclaim she achieved wasn't a source of some kind of underground pleasure for her. I mean, I think very few people cannot enjoy having other human beings applaud them and think well of them. We're social creatures. But I think in terms of what most motivated her, that was not it. And that, of course, she even if it had been, it would never have been something she embraced consciously. So that's where the biographer has to do a little sleuthing to sort of figure out, well, maybe, you know, was she seeking it actually, you know, even though she couldn't acknowledge it, or not? And I really tried to consider that in a careful way. I think that she definitely thrived on public acclaim, and I don't think that she ever allowed that pleasure to shape her decisions as to how she was going to respond to a particular political situation. The real test of just how much a person hungers for fame is whether they will seek fame over honoring their own moral principles or beliefs or what they care otherwise most about. And whenever it came to a choice between her reputation and the issues that she was working on, Adams never protected her reputation. There are lots of examples of that. You know, one of the more famous, there's two that are the most famous. One is during the Pullman strike of 1893, because there was 94, because Adams was not supporting George Pullman and all the business community of Chicago, which sided with him against his workers. They were striking for better wages and better working conditions. And Adams knew a lot of these workers. She was deeply connected to the labor movement, and she was trying to mediate between the two parties. But people in her class were expected, she was upper middle class in upbringing, were expected to side with the business community. And so many of the donors at Hull House were furious with her for not choosing sides. At the same time, many of the workers were furious at her for not choosing their side. And Adams suffered, you know, real public disapproval. And she lost donors. Hull House lost some donors because of her stance, but she didn't change it. And that happened in other situations, too. The other most famous one is her stand on World War I, and her commitment to pacifism prevented her from supporting it. And once again, it was a huge – it really destroyed her reputation for some years, but – that didn't affect her decision.
Yeah, it got her tossed out of the DAR.
Yes, which she liked to quip. I thought that was for a lifetime. It was an honorary lifetime membership. She said, I thought that was an honor for my life, but I guess it was only for good behavior.
Well, that I think it certainly does point out the fact that she, in her time, was, at least in some people's mind, a controversial figure. And while perhaps not as radical as some other women political activists of her time, the ones that are always, you know, on the radical list, people like Mother Jones and Emma Goldman, she certainly was regarded as by the establishment in many ways as a troublesome figure.
Yeah, depending on the times, but that's exactly right. I mean, one of the interesting things about studying Adams is to realize the extent to which, this is true for everyone, of course, their positions look radical or conservative depending on what's going on around them in the country, what the current debates are. And we can see that in our own lives, too. An issue, you know, that once was radical no longer is. And then it becomes radical again sometimes. And that happened to Adams. So she moved in and out of being considered radical or not.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Louise Knight. She is the author of a new biography of Jane Addams. The title of the book is Jane Addams' Spirit in Action. It's published by W.W. Norton. It is, in fact, her second book on Addams, the first Citizen Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy. Follows her up to the point of age 39, I believe. And
yeah.
Then this book is a more comprehensive, it's a total life portrait of Jane Addams. And it's out now. And questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455.
Could I just mention before we continue
sure.
that you were kind enough to refer to the talk I'm giving on December 12th. That is actually sold out. It's sponsored by the AUW Illinois, and they had a great interest in coming to hear a talk about Addams because she was a member of AUW Chicago branch. And so the tickets have been sold out. However, I am giving a talk on Friday, December 10th, at the Palmer House under the auspices of the Jane Addams Hull House Association, and that is the social services agency that Jane Addams founded and which continues to be an important agency in the city. And they're having a breakfast at the Palmer House that I believe starts at 8 o'clock, and I'm speaking and also selling and signing books there. And that is open to others, and people are invited to come. It's actually a free breakfast. They just need to contact the Jane Addams Hull House Association to RSVP. There's a phone number for that on my website also.
Right, and it's, again, if people will go to louisewknight.com, your website, and go to appearances, if they look at the list there, that'll be the and upcoming events, that'll be the very first thing that's right on the top of the list there. So, again, that's on Friday morning of this week, and the phone number is there if you'd like to be a part of that.
And there's also one more thing to mention. On Saturday, the 11th, I'm also giving a talk at Petrino's restaurant, which is a group of friends, really, who believe in Jane Addams and wanted to do something to celebrate Jane Addams Day, have organized a light brunch at this restaurant. And there'll be Jan Huttner will be performing Jane Addams in a marvelous costume she has. And I'll be giving some remarks about Jane Addams and the progressive tradition. And that's that information about that is on my website also.
Great. And again, if people want to read, there are the two books that are out. And questions here are welcome. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. She was born into a wealthy family. I don't know if you know this is all a kind of relative, but certainly it was they were well-to-do. Her father was a businessman in the northern part of the state. He was in Illinois politics. So she definitely had a privileged childhood, and one would imagine that for a woman of her class, her life might have taken a different direction. Why do you think it was that she became the person that she became?
Yeah, well, that's the question, isn't it? And that's really what prompted me to write the first book, Citizen. And that's why the first book only covered the first half of her life, because I found so much material to try and answer that question that it took up a whole book. And it intrigued me, because I think that anyone who starts off born in one class and manages to travel beyond the barriers that that class creates for them is really done something quite transformational and important to understand for all of us, because because human growth, I think, is such a fascinating capacity that we all have. And when that growth happens from a person who was born to a privileged class, I think it introduces a lot of questions about how well they come to understand the issue of class itself. For Addams, there were a couple of factors. A very important one was that she was raised in an evangelical Christian family. And in the 19th century, she was born in 1860, the evangelical Christian movement was very widespread and not particularly conservative. In fact, it was much more a reform-minded movement, and with an interest in improving society. Now, there remained a focus on individual salvation, but in addition, there was a feeling that that Christians needed to do something to broadly to help society become a better place. And Jane Addams' father, who was himself, of course, an evangelical Christian, was a state senator in Illinois, and he worked to found public institutions to serve dependent citizens like those who were blind and deaf, those who were needed mental hospitalization, which included his own son, and helped to found educational institutions. He was on the committee that actually voted to locate the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. So he was interested in government as a tool for improving society, and that obviously had an impact on Addams, too. And then in general, I think the Christian message, which permeated her childhood and her college education and continued to permeate her readings, motivated her to care about those who were suffering, those who were the poor, and that was another piece of what she stayed focused on in her younger years. Without that, I'm not sure she would have decided to do something to completely reform her life.
Mm-hmm.
The other factor, I think, was a mixture of her ambition and the timing of when she was a young woman, because she was a young woman. She was in high school in the 1870s, entered college in 1877. These were breakthrough years for college-age women, just the beginning of when women were able to go to college and earn BAs for the first time. And Addams really wanted to be part of that group. She was very disappointed. Her father would not let her go to Smith College, and she had to go to Rockford Seminary, which was nearby, and didn't offer quite the same bachelor's of arts education. But she had a desire to really push herself beyond what was normally expected of women. That was her ambition. It was also her opportunity given when she was born. And so she was looking around for ways to do that after she got out of college, and the settlement movement came across her bow, and that was a breakthrough idea, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made it possible for her to do something that took her out of her class background, that dropped her into a working-class neighborhood. And so I think all those factors were influences.
Something else in her life that it's hard to ignore just because it seems to have been such a strong presence. She suffered a great deal of personal loss, which perhaps for a person of her time would not be that unusual. Her mother died when she was only two. She, by the time she was a relatively young girl, she had lost four other siblings. And I think around the time that she was in college, her father died. She lost a lot of people who were close to her.
Yeah, actually, three of those siblings died before she was born. Hmm. But one died when she was six, and then her father died after she graduated from college right after. Yeah, and of course, losing a mother when you're two is beyond human understanding. You know, one of the challenges of writing a book about someone who has experienced death so intimately, so early, is exactly how to understand the impact of that on her life. And when I first started working on Citizen, I was sort of hoping I wouldn't have to deal with that very much, to tell you the truth, because I didn't want to make it sound as if, well, she lost her mother when she was two, and therefore a lot of things followed from that, as if that would be true for everyone who lost a mother when they were a child, which of course is not. You know, not all of them become world-famous leaders of social reform. But as I both read Addams' writings and also learned more about the impact of losing one's parent very early, I began to realize that death loomed very large in Addams' consciousness in ways she didn't fully realize, but it kept cropping up in her writings very powerfully. And so I gradually came to understand, and this had to be reflected in both books, of course, that Addams' sense of what death meant to her was really powerfully shaped by the power death had over her at such a tender age. She perceived death as, first of all, terrifying, and second of all, a force beyond control, and third of all, something that she had to do something about, because that's sort of the human instinct when something horrible happens, is that you should have done something, or what can you do now? And you see this in some of the dreams she had, and then in her early ambition. So I think in the long run, death played a big role, and readers will have to decide for themselves whether I've made sense of that puzzle in the books.
Perhaps we can come back to how it is that she came across the concept of the settlement house, which was at the time, I think, when she was involved in setting up Hull House. There was about the same time there was one that was set up in New York, and it was only a few years previous that the first one in the world anywhere came into being in London. How did she come across the idea?
Well, actually, she read it in a magazine. Isn't that great? I have a theory, which is some of the most wonderful life-changing projects people learn about the ideas first in magazine articles. It seems to be true. But anyway, she read it in a magazine article, and it was the first settlement house in the world had just been founded in London, and its name was Toynbee Hall. And it was written up in a magazine and called the Century Magazine, and she read it there, and she was already just planning to go to Europe for the second time. This was in the summer of 1887, and she knew she could therefore go and visit Toynbee Hall when she was in Europe, and decided that she was going to do that. She had not told anyone that she had already had a dream to go live in a working-class neighborhood, use her wealth that she had inherited from her father when he died to rent a house, bring some other young women like Adams who were feeling frustrated that they were so isolated from real life, and see what happened. That was sort of her very vague dream. When she read about the settlement house, she saw a way to actually make it happen, because that the settlement house was that idea, although for men, and it was a sort of more structured than anything she had figured out. So she finally got the courage to tell her college friend Ellen Gates Starr when they were traveling in Spain about her dream and about the idea of the settlement house in London, and Ellen wonderfully said, "That's a great idea. I would love to join you." And so they decided they would visit Toynbee Hall. And Adams did visit. Ellen, unfortunately, was unable to visit because she had to accompany some students of the school where she was teaching to Italy. All the books say that Starr went too, but that's wrong. Not that it matters a lot. But Adams did visit Toynbee Hall, and she and Ellen did decide to start one, and that's what happened in the fall of 1889.
We are just about at our midpoint here. Let me again, for the benefit of anybody who just tuned in, introduce the guest, Louise Knight. She is a writer. She's a former journalist, a college administrator. She's the author of two books about Jane Addams. The first is titled Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy, and that book covers roughly the first half of her life, Jane Addams' life. And she is also the author of a new book that is an overview of her entire life. The title of that book is Jane Addams, Spirit in Action, and it is published by W.W. Norton, and the book's out now. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like, you can send us an email if you'd like to join in the conversation that way. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm sure that a lot of people have heard of Hull House, maybe have a kind of vague idea of what it was. What actually happened at Hull House? What did they do there?
Yes, well, that's also a really interesting question. A lot of times in history textbooks and brief descriptions of Hull House, it's described as an institution that served the poor and, you know, tried to mitigate the suffering of the poor. And that's actually just one aspect of what Hull House did and not its central function. It had two main functions, as Adams understood it from the beginning, and Ellen, of course, was completely in agreement. One was educational, and this was for working people, not the poorest of the poor, but the people who lived in this industrial neighborhood that they rented a house in. It was on the near west side of Chicago. Lots of factories, lots of people working to barely make ends meet, but they were working. And they had not had these were immigrants mostly, but not completely, from Europe. And they had never had a chance to get an education. So Adams, who was a big enthusiast of education, and Ellen, also a teacher, offered classes for anyone who wanted to take them on great works. It was somewhat idealistic, but they did find workers who wanted this, and so they taught George Eliot's novels, like Romola, which is about takes place in Italy, and some Italian immigrants wanted to read Romola. And they studied Mazzini's Duties of Man. The other Italians wanted to study that because Mazzini was a major figure in their history. And so they had lots of classes. And then, in addition, the Hull House was supposed to be a social place, meaning a place where neighbors could gather and get to know each other. And so there were parties. The ethnic groups, it turned out, wanted to have their own ethnic party, so the Italians had their party, the Germans had their party, and the French Canadians had their party, and then also ways for them to get to know each other, mingling across their different ethnic lines. So there were clubs for the kids and clubs for the adults, and it was a wonderfully creative place. And then there were lectures that were offered on all sorts of subjects. And there was lectures offered for workers interested in radical reform of the economy. And they had speakers come from all different kinds of backgrounds to talk about socialism or nationalism, which was a new theory that was floating around different meeting than it has now. And so this was a very busy, active place. The role of the sort of compassionate help to the poor was just the neighborly role that Adams understood was automatic, that anyone did if you lived in a neighborhood. So if someone was in crisis, they came to Hull House and got help. If a woman was having a baby and no one would help her because it was a baby out of wedlock, someone was sent to Hull House and somebody went out to help deliver the baby. If someone was sick, someone, Adams or Starr or one of the other people that joined them, would go and take care of the sick person. If a child needed caring for, they would take care of the child. So there was plenty of compassionate help, but that was not the main function of the settlement house. It was much more to create social connections across class lines.
All right, let's talk with some listeners. Indiana, we have a caller there. Line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Of all the people you've had for a period of time, I think I've gotten more facts about somebody in the short period she's talked than about anybody. It's rather remarkable. It took me back to my days when I read about her in our textbook in grade school, junior high school probably. And David at the beginning rattled off some of the things she had accomplished, and I said, they never told us about that. She was just the lady that had this place in Chicago. Then sort of haphazardly you talked about, she taught about the great book. Or there was a fellow there called Mortimer J. Adler, I believe, who started a group of books called The Great Books, in which some of the Greek works are the only place you can get them. They're translated, but you have to buy the entire set. I found that rather interesting. I guess I'm just rambling because I rather found the whole thing astounding. But I guess to ask a question, something academic, you mentioned that she didn't go there. I was wondering if you could come up with how you found that out, how you footnoted it, and whether it will be taken into, you know, more recent scholarship about her life. Thank you.
Yes, it was Ellen Gates Starr who didn't visit Toynbee Hall. Jane Addams did. And what a great question. Historians don't always get to answer that kind of question, but it's fun to do. First of all, we know that Adams went there because there are letters surviving where she wrote to her sister right after visiting Toynbee Hall and said, oh, this is the most amazing place, I've learned all this, I've learned that. So that's how we know Adams visited. The reason we know that Starr didn't visit is because we have letters between Adams and Starr explaining that she had to go be with the students she was chaperoning in Italy. And so, and we also know the date when Jane Addams left England. The original plan was that Starr and Addams that Addams was going to stay in London after her first visit, wait for Starr to arrive, and then they were going to go visit again. And again, historians have read that letter and assumed that it happened. But what I did that nobody else had done was look at the date that Jane Addams left England and the date that Ellen Gates Starr arrives in England. And Addams had to leave England unexpectedly because her stepbrother was having a mental breakdown, and she got a letter from her sister explaining this and urging her to come. And so she got on the next boat. And so she, unfortunately, was not in England when Ellen arrived. Therefore, we know they couldn't have visited Toynbee Hall together.
All right.
And as far as whether that will get registered in terms of printed versions of this question, it takes a long time, it turns out, because books survive on bookshelves forever. And then, of course, the information gets repeated on websites. And so even though I have had this information published in print since 2005, I have yet to see it picked up by anyone.
Very well. Let's go to another caller. This is Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. The other, there's a lot of education going on there, and this is kind of a tangential way of getting at a broader question, that Benny Goodman studied trumpet there, which he was a young Jewish boy at the time. I don't know if he was studying classical trumpet, but I'm just thinking of the whole ferment of the age. And there's a book out called Keep Cool about how jazz and radicalism sort of travel together. And it made me think that there had to be this dynamic that we still see today between sort of progressive religious types, more secular types. All of this, I don't know if there's any anecdote that captures any of this dimension of what was going on, and just sort of as a afterthought question is, was there a dossier on the government dossier on Jane Addams that you were able to look at? Because, I mean, Helen Keller is remembered, but
yeah,
everybody remembers she was blind, but they don't remember she was a socialist, so I don't know if you can illuminate any of this.
Sure. Yeah, first on Benny Goodman, he had started playing the trumpet before he came to Hull House as a child. Of course, he lived in the neighborhood. But what he joined at Hull House was the boys' band, and that was the first band he'd ever played in. So Hull House can get some credit for that. And I suspect, although I don't know how documentable it is, that his open-mindedness to playing with African Americans, which of course he's known for, could have been nurtured at Hull House also, because children of all backgrounds were welcome there, and there was, you know, if any child had a prejudice against a child of a different background, it was not tolerated. But in any case, he was one of the more famous children that was involved at Hull House. Regarding Jane Addams's government dossier, the answer is yes. The head of the FBI, Mr. Hoover, was paying attention to Addams for a long time before he was actually named head of the FBI, which didn't exist during World War I, of course. He opened a file on her. She was spied upon during the war. After the war was when he moved into his spying role at the Department of Justice, and Hoover was asked by the War Department to open up a file on Addams. He sent spies to observe a meeting of the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom in Washington, and that file grew and grew and grew. And throughout the 20s, really, she was considered a radical, a socialist, and very dangerous. In fact, the story goes that Hoover called her the most dangerous woman in America. Of course, that label was also applied to Mother Jones. It was applied to Emma Goldman. So, and Teddy Roosevelt has been credited with saying that about Jane Addams. So who knows who said it, really. But in any case, it certainly fit with Hoover's views of Addams.
Hmm. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We're heading into our last 15 minutes here. We're talking with Louise Knight about Jane Addams. Louise Knight is the author of the new biography, Jane Addams, Spirit in Action. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Talk about, if you would, her involvement in the founding of the NAACP.
Yeah, the NAACP was founded in 1909, and this was a period when riots in cities, racial riots, were suddenly erupting, and there was also massive lynching of African Americans. not only in the South, I should point out, but also in the North. Now, lynching had been going on for a long time. It really increased against African Americans in the 1890s. But by 1909, more African Americans were moving north. It wasn't the Great Migration yet, but there was some shift. And in Springfield, Illinois, there was a terrible riot. And that was one of the things that caused some settlement house workers in New York City to say, we've got to do something. We need to create a black-white organization that's going to work on the issue of race, racial relations. Adams was invited to the organizing meeting in New York City. She wasn't able to go, but in her absence, she was named to the committee that was to draw up the charter for the new organization, and she was named to the founding board, and she served on that board from its first meeting until her death. The NAACP was a bold new kind of race organization in the sense that it was going to use the law to push for equal rights for African Americans. And what's interesting to me as Adams' biographer is that she was comfortable with that because Adams is famous and appropriately known for being a woman who tried to find compromise through democratic process. She believed in collaboration and cooperation. She didn't embrace conflict as a solution very comfortably. It's one of the things I most admire about her, that she became to recognize the need for conflict in certain circumstances when power was way out of whack. Mm-hmm. One area was in the labor movement because workers had so little power in their relations to their employers that they needed unions, they needed the right to organize, and if necessary, they needed the right to strike. And Adams became a supporter of that right. Similarly, for African Americans, given the incredible power that whites had in society and the domination of racism as a viewpoint that permeated society, the African Americans were going to need the power of law to crack open the system. And Adams understood that and supported the NAACP in its methods.
All right. Let's talk with another listener here, someone in Wilmette. Line four. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned earlier that, you know, there was some fairly high cultural stuff at the kind of educational aspect at Hull House. How successful was she in teaching stuff like George Eliot? And if so, do you think that's relevant today? It seems like you couldn't get away with trying to teach that kind of stuff in a similar setting today. I'd be interested in your thoughts, and I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Thanks. That's really a great question. And several thoughts occur to me. On the whole, Adams realized that for the larger number of people living in the neighborhood, these offerings of great texts wasn't necessarily what they were interested in. But there were always people in the neighborhood who were interested, and many of them were really stretched to be able to take such classes. And so for the people who wanted it, it was a tremendous success and a great gift. And they also offered a summer school at Rockford College, Jane Addams' alma mater, for working girls to come and have an experience of living on a campus and taking similar classes, studying languages, reading great books. And that also continued for four or five summers, I think. And for those girls, it was a tremendous success. However, on the whole, Adams decided that Hull House needed to diversify its educational offerings. And so they began to offer a wider range of things. They, of course, offered citizenship classes because many immigrants wanted to become citizens. They offered letter writing classes because many immigrants wanted to learn how to write letters. They offered vocational education. They had shop classes and pottery classes. And then the arts that were the most successful at Hull House were the performing arts. They had a thriving theater and dance and everything like that. But to pick up on your other point about how radical that idea is today, there are actually programs, and I know one program that was conceived at Stanford University and has been spread around the country and draws faculty from universities to teach in the cities, major cities of the nation, in working class neighborhoods, and offer short courses in great books. And it's been a fabulous success. So, but it is unusual, and I think we have to think outside of the box to realize that everybody can enjoy these great pieces of literature.
All right, and another caller here. This is someone in Elmhurst, also line four. Hello.
Yes, well, I have a couple questions.
Sure.
One is involving contemporary concepts like multiculturalism. I wonder if she, by our standards, was promoting an Americanization over, moreover, than celebrating the variety of cultures she dealt with. And the second question is on a more personal level, did you discover anything about her sexuality, how she expressed it? Those are the two questions.
Great. Great questions. On the subject of Americanization, which, as some people know these days, is a shorthand for saying that Settlement House workers were trying to sort of erase the ethnic diversity of their neighbors and make them American as soon as possible. Adams was really opposed to that, and she stood out from many Settlement House workers in that viewpoint. She entirely respected the ethnic diversity of her neighbors. In fact, she loved it. She enjoyed it. She loved to learn from them about their different cultures. She encouraged them to enjoy their cultures and to not feel ashamed of them. She also understood, however, and this is important to remember, that immigrants themselves wanted to become Americans, not by disrespecting their home cultures, but by also embracing the parts of America they wanted to embrace, which often includes English, learning English, because, of course, how do you get ahead in a nation that speaks English if you don't learn it? And that was something Adams was happy to help with, too. So historians are sometimes oversimplify this whole question and become very schematic. And in Adams' case, it was I think, a position that most people would think was a very appropriate one. She wanted to help the immigrants in the ways they wanted to become American, and she didn't want them to ever be ashamed of their own cultures or not celebrate them in this country as well. Hmm. As far as her sexuality goes, this was one of my biographical challenges to figure out. Jane Addams had a lifelong partner, Mary Rose Smith. They considered themselves married. They were devoted to each other. They were a couple in the eyes of their friends, and of course they had friends who were, we now know historically, actually lesbian. But what to call Addams and Smith? Were they a lesbian couple? My answer is, depends how you define lesbian. I think it's fine to define lesbian as someone who has a same-sex partnership, and in that case, yes, she was. The question of her sexuality, though, is hard to unpack. Addams was a Platonist, which means that she thought that sex was a lower passion. She thought it was a normal, healthy human passion. But being an idealist, she wanted to sublimate her sexual desires into a love of beauty. And she writes about this as an ideal for everyone, knowing that it isn't possible for many. And I think that's what she did in her relationship with Mary Rose Smith. At least we have no evidence otherwise, and so that's the best answer we can give.
Hmm. I think, you know, maybe that gets to the fact that nowadays perhaps we might find it, the idea of a relationship that was very close and very intimate, that comes right up to the line of being sexual and yet not, is something perhaps we have a hard time understanding.
Absolutely. In fact, I thought a lot about that. I appreciate you making that point, because I think that's exactly right. This is the most highly sexualized society since London in the 18th century, which was pretty sexualized. And I don't think we even understand that, because, you know, the power of commercial industries to keep sex in front of us all the time is unmatched in the history of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. You know, people enjoy sex. That's wonderful. But in Adam's day, it was not like that. And so it's hard for us to fathom that someone would be able to or want to restrain their sexuality.
And this, too, I think that it's clearly, if you look at the details of her life, she never married, she never had children. She had this very close, intimate relationship with this woman, and clearly there was another, the other woman you mentioned, Ellen Gade Starr, was they certainly were very close. Mm-hmm. Don't know exactly what that relationship might have been, but they were apparently very close. So that's the kind of thing that's there, and yet it seems to be something that when you read about Jane Addams, not you, but I think other writers have tiptoed around this because they're not really quite sure what to do with it. And I think that in fact that some people might ask the question, does that matter? Is that something that really, is it appropriate to discuss that aspect of her life?
Well, yeah, and I wrestled with that too, obviously. And I thought it mattered for a couple of reasons. The first being that I was publishing in 2005 and 2010, and these are issues on the minds of my readers. I owe them the answer as best I can. But the second answer is that sexuality is always an important part of every human being. I don't think our modern view is wrong in that regard, and therefore I think it does round out our understanding of Addams to know how she viewed it. She encouraged sex education in the schools, which is, you know, another clue that she wasn't a prude about sex. And so I think it's important to give the whole picture, and I try and do that. But her idealism, her Platonist idealism, gets right to the heart of who Jane Addams was, how important these big ideas were to shaping her daily behavior, that the kind of self-discipline she exercised. So I think it's a window on that, too.
Something else that I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about, and we're coming down to just a couple of minutes left, how it is that she thought about the people that she was trying to help, and perhaps how that might have changed over time from the point where she started out, where she might have come to it with the attitude that the privileges with which she was born, with that comes a certain kind of responsibility, but that may also imply a certain kind of relationship between the helper and the helped, and that was something that over the course of her life really changed.
Yeah, that was one of the most difficult things for me to sort out, because most of the writings that Addams left us were published after she herself changed her viewpoint. And so it's, historians have sort of automatically assumed, working with that material that's published after 1900, that Addams arrived at Hull House with an understanding that class differences were irrelevant, that she was a social equal, not only a social equal, but an equal in every way, and that she had profound respect for the working people around her. Now, to make it more complicated, she did embrace those ideas when she first arrived at Hull House. But what I discovered through a fair amount of careful sleuth work was that she actually, in addition to believing that she was socially equal to working class people, she also believed she was culturally superior because she had traveled in Europe, visited the great art museums, visited the opera house, studied the great minds of Europe, and had gotten a college education as well. So this was an attitude extremely common in her class. It would have been bizarre if she hadn't had it, and she had it when she arrived at Hull House. So she went through a sort of a crisis in the 1890s trying to sort this out, and became wiser by a series of experiences, not all of which, of course, we have a record for, but one was discovering the dangers of self-righteousness in George Pullman. And that helped her see that self-righteousness, this confidence in one's moral superiority, was a very dangerous thing. And that was a breakthrough moment for her, and lots of other experiences as well. But she came to understand that she did not define civilized or cultured anymore as being privileged in the way she was. She defined it as being having wide experience of human beings, and that's what described her neighbors, the working-class neighbors in Hull House, and that was what she came to understand, that they were just as wise and just as insightful as she was about life.
Hmm. Hull House is still standing. It's on the campus of the University of Illinois Chicago, and I think our preservation effort has been a little less than sterling, but but the house is there. What can you see there today?
Well, they have a brand new exhibit there, just put up this fall in honor of the 150th anniversary of Jane Addams' birth, funded by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And you will see there the story of all the wonderful reformers that passed through Hull House and the work that they did, and also a history of the architecture of the house. and it's quite an interesting exhibit.
What anybody else really, people of note, some or Benny Goodman came up in the conversation earlier, people of note in whatever kind of activity that had spent time at Hull House?
Well, some of the most remarkable women reformers of the Progressive era were actually residents at Hull House. These are not household names necessarily, but they were back then. One was Florence Kelly, another was Julia Lathrop, and another was Alice Hamilton, the first professor of at Harvard Medical School, who was a woman. There were plenty of famous people who passed through. There were also some amazing men who were residents at Hull House briefly. One became the head of Canada, the Prime Minister of Canada, no less. There was a law professor at Northwestern was a resident there. The famous writers like Ida Tarbell visited often. Ida Wells Barnett, the leader of the anti-lynching crusade, visited there, was a friend of Jane Addams and an admirer. W.B. Du Bois spoke at Hull House. John Dewey was on its board. So it was an amazing place.
Well, we're going to have to stop with the suggestion that if you'd like to read more about the life of Jane Addams, you can look for the book that we've talked about, Jane Addams, Spirit in Action, by our guest Louise Knight. It's just out, published by Norton. You might also look at her earlier book, Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy. And then again, we'll mention that coming up later this week on Friday and Saturday, there are a couple of events happening in Chicago. So if you're people who are listening to us this morning on Chicago, can hear and see our guest, Louise Knight. And again, this is on the 11th and the 12th?
The 10th.
The 11th and the 10th?
Yes. It's on my – the information's on the website.
All right. So, yes, for people who are interested in finding out more about that, we talked about it a little bit earlier, but maybe the easiest way is to go to louisewknight.com, our guest's website. Go to appearances there, and the information is right there up top. And Ms. Knight, we want to say to you, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Excellent questions.